to you our speaker. Rebecca Hibbs is the program manager of the Driver Responsibility Program, which I'm sure you probably know more commonly as the Points and Surcharges Program. She has been with the DPS, has it been over 10 years now? Have you hit the 10-year mark?
It's 10 years now, yeah.
Okay. It says over 9, but I know this is a few months old. So 10 years she's been with DPS and has spent the entire time in the driver license division. So she is the authority on the Points and Surcharges Program. I'm sure you get a lot of questions from defendants about that, and she does as well throughout the state. So help me welcome Rebecca Hibbs.
How are y'all this afternoon? Good. Ready for the last hour? Okay. Well, as y'all know, this is on driver license programs, and unfortunately, they're not always the most entertaining. There's a lot of information, maybe not so, you know, fun to talk about, but we'll try and make it as informative and interesting for you this afternoon as possible. If you have questions as we go along, please feel free to raise your hand. I'll be more than happy to answer your questions for you. We're actually going to cover 3 different topics today. Hopefully, we'll provide you some good information before you leave, and we're going to go ahead and get started. There's 3 things we're going to discuss today. We're going to talk about some updates to the Driver Responsibility Program, which, as y'all know, is what we call surcharges. We're also going to talk about driving while license invalid and how that affects your courts now, since there's been changes in the law. And we're going to finish that up with commercial driver license disqualifications that have been around for a while, but just to give y'all some reminders and some refreshers on that. So as we start with the surcharge program, how many of y'all have ever gone through one of the presentations that we've done related to it? Oh, y'all haven't? Are you familiar with the program at all? A couple of y'all have? Okay, slightly. Well, then I may modify this just a little bit to give y'all some more background information as we go along. Otherwise, the updates really aren't going to mean a lot to you. Surcharges are assessed based on certain types of convictions or an accumulation of convictions. So what that means is there are 5 categories where we assess surcharges. One is called points. And unfortunately, most people think that that's the only way that they get surcharges is related to points, and that's not actually true. Points means that you got an accumulation of moving violations, things like speeding, you ran a red light, that type of regular moving violation. You get 2 points for each one of those convictions that appears on your record, and when you accumulate 6 points, we assess you a surcharge of $100, okay? That's the points portion. Yes, ma'am. It's a final conviction. So if you've reported it to the department as a conviction, then it will be placed on the driver record. If it's been dismissed, if it's been deferred, then those don't appear on the driver record. So yes, we're talking about final convictions right here when we discuss these. So that's the points portion. There is another portion that was what we call standalone or more serious surcharges, and it happens immediately. So when a conviction is reported for either an intoxication offense, for no insurance, no driver license, or driving while license is invalid, we assess a surcharge immediately. And unfortunately, those are usually a lot higher. A no driver license is also $100 a year, and that's for 3 years. I'm sorry, when we talk about surcharges, they're assessed annually for 3 years. No insurance and DWLI are $250 a year for 3 years, and intoxication offenses have a range. If it's your first time DWI, it's $1,000 a year for 3 years. If it's a subsequent DWI, it's $1,500 a year for 3 years. And if you happen to have a DWI with a blood alcohol content of 0.16 or more, it's $2,000 a year for 3 years. That's correct, yeah. On the 0.16, it doesn't matter if it's a first or a subsequent because it has a higher BAC. They consider it to have a higher surcharge, so it's $2,000 regardless of when you get it. Yes, ma'am. Okay. When we call it no driver license, actually the way it's written in the statute is you're driving without a valid license for the vehicle that you're operating. So it runs a gamut of things. It means you either didn't have a driver license and you're operating in a regular vehicle, or maybe you don't have a commercial license, you have a regular one, but you were operating a commercial motor vehicle. You have no motorcycle license, but you're operating a motorcycle. So those are the no license offenses. It also applies to an expired driver license. It also applies if you violate an endorsement on your license, meaning you're driving a commercial motor vehicle, it's a tanker, but you don't have the tank endorsement, so you're not licensed to operate that vehicle. All of those fall under the no driver license category. Fail to display license, though, does not, because it means you actually have a valid license, you just didn't have it on you to display it to the officer. Okay? So fail to display is the only one of those that does not apply to the surcharges. All of the rest of them do. The thing that's important to note about surcharges is that they're cumulative. So if you get, and we're going to use DWI as an example, if you get your first DWI and we assess you the $1,000 a year for 3 years, let's say 6 months later you get your second DWI conviction, we don't change your surcharge and say, oh, now you're going to pay $1,500. That $1,500 a year for 3 years is on top of the $1,000 that you're already paying for the first, which means that you now have an individual who has two DWI convictions and will have a total of $4,500 in surcharges that they're going to pay to us. $3,000 for the first one, $4,500 for the second. I'm sorry. Actually, let's take that back. That's $7,500 that person's going to owe us for their two DWIs. Same thing goes for no insurance. If they get multiple no insurances, it's $250 a year for 3 years for each no insurance conviction. So that is why most individuals do not participate or like to participate in the surcharge program, because it is not easy. One of the things that we found as we started implementing this is that there were certain areas where we have issues with collections. One of them is because you have individuals who are recidivists. You know, they have multiple offenses. Because of the amount of the surcharges, they accumulate to a point where those individuals feel like they can't comply with the surcharge that they're being assessed. We also have individuals who may be low income, things of that nature. And so it has garnered a lot of complaints by constituents to their legislators. And during the last legislative session, they decided to make some changes. Some of them were to provide some relief to the customers. Some of them were also to an attempt to collect additional monies. Right now, our collection rate is only 37%. It doesn't sound all that great, and really, from a percentage standpoint, it isn't. But when you start looking at the dollar amounts that we are billing and collecting, you'll understand why. To give you an example, right now we have assessed about $1.5 billion in revenue. And yes, that is B, billion, and that's only been in the past 5-year period because we began in September of 2004. Of that, we have collected a little over $600 million, okay? So while we are collecting a large portion of money for the state, obviously we're not collecting the full amount. So that's what some of these changes were that took place with this bill that we have up here, Senate Bill 1723. Yes, ma'am. The funds that are collected actually go to two places. Well, I'm sorry, we'll take that back, three. 49.5% of the money is collected and distributed to the Trauma Center Fund and Emergency Services Fund. That fund is actually administered by the Department of State Health Services. The other 49.5% actually goes to the General Revenue Fund, and of course, that can be dispersed as the legislature chooses. The remaining 1% out of that comes back to the department, and we use that for the administration of the program. During the last legislative session, they actually passed Senate Bill 1723, and what that said is, okay, we want to do three things. We want to make some changes to your installment plans because we're finding that there are some issues with it. We want to go ahead and have y'all start increasing your collections. So we're going to give you some other options that you can go through. And then they also provided some programs that would allow for reductions of surcharges. So that's what we're going to talk about here. The additional collection methods. Basically, prior to this, when a person entered into the surcharge program, they got their first notice, and that first notice was mailed to the address on record because that's what the statute requires. So you may have some individuals who didn't receive their notice because of the fact that they never changed their address with the department. So we encourage that highly. If they didn't comply within the first 30 days, because the statute says you have 30 days to make payment, you can either enter into an installment plan or you can pay the balance in full, but you must do it within the first 30 days. And if you fail to do so, then we will suspend your driving privileges indefinitely until you comply. And the only way to comply is to make payment. There's no other options for compliance. You can't do community service, time served. None of that applies with the surcharges. If a person failed to make the payment within 30 days, then what we do is we send out an additional notice to them. It's not required, but we did it anyways because we wanted to be able to make sure that we were reaching those individuals who didn't receive the first notice. And in order to do so, we attempted to look for a more current address for that individual by using a program known as National Change of Address. And it's a database that's hosted by the U.S. Postal Service. And what we would do is we would look for a more current address for that individual. If we can find one, we send their suspension notice to that address. It does actually capture a lot of individuals. Unfortunately, it doesn't always capture everybody. But those were only the two notices that we mailed out to individuals. And that was the only contact they received from the department. So we did have some individuals who, one, either never received the notice or, like anything else, fine, you sent me a notice that says I'm suspended, but I never hear from you again, so I'm going to opt to drive anyways. Of course, that puts them in a DWLI status, which means that if they get pulled over and ticketed and convicted, they're back in the surcharge program for that as well. Yes, ma'am. Believe it or not, we are probably one of the most customer-friendly options for payment. We are the state. We want your money, so we offer everything. You can pay cash. You can pay by check. That's business check, personal check, money orders. You can do wire transfers. You can do credit and debit cards. We also do electronic checks by phone. We'll take your money however you want to send it. The best way to, if you have individuals that are asking for different options, on our website, which is the department's website, I can give that address to y'all if you'd like it. It's www.txdps.state.tx.us. Right on the front homepage, there is one that says Driver Responsibility Program. If you have the person click on that, it sends you to a page for general information, frequently asked questions, how to pay, where they can pay it online. So one of the great things in the frequently asked questions, it's unfortunately a very long list, but it does provide all the different options on how they can pay. So that is available to them. Anyways, I'm sorry. So what we were saying is that we only gave them just those two notices. What we opted to do when the legislature said, we want you to try and increase your collections, is to start actually contacting these people on a regular basis. So the first thing we implemented was an additional notice that goes out every 6 months that a person stays in a defaulted status. Unfortunately, there are some individuals that every 6 months they get the notice from us, but at least we felt like we were still reminding those individuals, look, your driving privileges are still suspended. We really want you to comply with these. So here's our notification to you. In addition to that notice, we also allowed our vendor to actually use a process known as skip tracing. Are y'all familiar with that? Maybe? So basically what skip tracing is the ability to use a national database to locate a current address for an individual. It's almost like the Postal Service database, except the Postal Service only obtains that information when a person comes in and says, hey, I want to change my address with you. What the national databases do is they obtain information from financial institutions, mortgage companies, utility companies, whatever they can find that says this is the most current address for that individual. And so we will look for that person's address in that database, and if we can find it, that's the address we use in order to make sure we are reaching that person at their current location every time we send them the letter. The other thing that we do is we also look for a telephone number. We now have allowed our vendor to start making outbound telephone calls, which previously they were not allowed to do. They could take calls from customers, they just couldn't call out. Now they can do that, and so they do what we call a courtesy call. It is not a very aggressive technique that we're using right now. It is a soft approach, which basically says, look, we're calling you because you're in the program and we want you to be aware of that. You're currently suspended, which means, you know, your driving privileges are not valid, so don't drive. Here's why you're in the program and here's how it works, and this is what you can do to be in compliance. It's much more informative than it is right now as a collection tactic that you would normally think of when you think maybe like creditors calling people and asking for money. But we also begin doing that as well. So those are the two things that we have implemented so far. We are looking at other options as well. I'm not certain what those will be, but we will probably be implementing new techniques probably within the next year. Installment plans. We talk about, you know, one of the ways that people can comply is either to enter into an installment plan or they can pay their balance in full. Unfortunately, many individuals can't pay their balances in full just because of the amount of the surcharge itself. So we've always had the ability for them to enter into installment plans. But when the program was originally created, what it said was, if you enter into an installment plan and you default on that, then the statute says you have to pay the remaining balance in full. So we had individuals who were calling us and saying, I got laid off, I missed a payment because I had other expenses, I want to go back into the installment plan, and unfortunately the law did not allow us to do that. So this bill also made the change that allows the department to let people re-enter into installment plans rather than making them pay the balance in full. By administrative rule, we actually changed it that says you can re-enter one time only, and if you default a second time, then you do have to pay the remaining balance in full. But the thing about reentry is that there is no penalty to the customer. They don't have to make up missed payments. They don't pay any interest. They don't pay any additional fees. The only thing they have to do is submit their regular monthly payment, and it automatically enters them back into the installment plan. So it's almost like they're picking up where they left off. One of the other things that we did in relationship to the installment plans, this was mostly as a courtesy to customers because we had individuals who were calling and saying, I can't make my payment on the date you're telling me it's due, is we are now allowing them also to change their due date. The due date is set by the system based on the day we send out the notice. So if we send out your notice on July 1st, then your payments are due by the 1st of each month. If we send it out on July 23rd, then they're due by the 23rd of each month. Unfortunately, we found that that's not always conducive to people's ways that they receive their payments. Some people get paid once a week, but some only get paid once a month. And so we allow them to make that change, and all they have to do is contact us, and we'll make the change to whatever date's most convenient to them. The last thing that they did in this particular bill was to create three programs, which they called amnesty, incentive, and indigency programs. They were very generic, though, in their statement. They just said that we're going to allow the department to reduce surcharges, not waive them, but you can reduce them, no specific amount for the reduction. But the only thing that required is that the person either showed some type of rehabilitation with the law or some type of compliance with the law in order for them to receive the reduction. So there were two programs that we created by administrative rule. All of these apply to surcharges that were assessed on or after September 1st, 2007. Unfortunately, these programs are not in place right now. We anticipate having them in place, hopefully, by about September of this year. But there are rules already written, so they'll apply this way. The amnesty program is specific to no insurance and no driver license surcharges. And what we're trying to do is have people show that they are rehabilitating themselves and starting to comply with the laws that they originally violated. So, for example, with the no insurance, if you have a person who has a no insurance conviction and we've assessed them their first surcharge, if they can show us proof that they are obtaining insurance and keeping that insurance valid for the time period that they pay their surcharges, then we'll reduce it by 25% each year. But we need to see that, and we're going to have to validate it, but we'll need to see that they're keeping up that insurance. If they ever cancel their insurance or they let it lapse, then that reduction is voided and they have to pay the original surcharge amount. We're really trying to make sure that people are doing one of two things. One, keeping the road safe, because we obviously know no insurance and no driver license are actually the largest number of surcharges that we assess. They cover about 75% of the surcharges that we send out. But we also want to make sure that people are actually keeping up with that particular part of the law. The other program that we created was the incentive program, and that is an automatic reduction to individuals who either have a points, intoxication, or a DWLI surcharge. It doesn't require that individual to do anything other than stay in compliance with the law. So they pay their first year surcharge in full, and when we get ready to assess them their second year, if they've gotten no other convictions on their record that would be assessed a surcharge, then we're going to automatically reduce their second year surcharge by 10%. And on the third year, we'll reduce it by 20%, again, if they've received no additional convictions. The third portion of that is the indigency program. And when we wrote the administrative rules, we did not have an indigency program in place that we could develop. During this most recent session, the one that just ended, they actually wrote a new law that is not effective until September 2011, but I'm going to discuss it with y'all anyways because it will have some impact on the courts. They said that they wanted us to develop an indigency program that would not reduce but would completely waive a surcharge if a person was found indigent. But the determination of indigency occurs by the court at the time the person is being convicted for their offense. The thing that's interesting to note about the way that they wrote this particular statute is that although you may have indigency hearing processes in place already, they actually defined a list of what people could present to the court to show indigency. So it's kind of outside of your normal process already. But basically what we would do in this particular instance is when you submit the conviction to us, we would probably just have you update your electronic process or the notification process to us to say, hey, this person's also indigent. And so when we receive that conviction, we just will not assess the surcharge for them. Again, that's not effective until September of 2011. So there is always the ability of the legislature to change that during the next session. But that's just something that you might want to keep in mind as we get closer to that date. Yes, sir.
Let me get this straight. When a person comes to our court, we're going to do the indigency determination.
Yes, sir.
Everything else we get to do.
Yes.
And then we tell you guys, this one's in. But they're going to send us the guidelines to determine if this person meets his criteria, right?
Yeah, they actually wrote it into the statute for the driver responsibility program.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I don't remember it right off the top of my head. I wish I would have brought the bill with me. It's actually under House Bill 2730, which is the department's sunset bill. But they actually define a list of things like your indigent based off of your income tax, wages that you earn, if you're a full-time student. If you receive certain type of health or insurance benefits, yes, they specifically listed them out.
I don't guess there's any corresponding issue like the state fees, you know, they share with us for bookkeeping. Is this something we're going to do out of the goodness of our heart?
Oh, you mean like an unfunded mandate? We don't have those, right? As far as I know, yes. I did not see any appropriations riders that were associated with that bill. That would probably be why you would want to keep that in your mind as we approach the next session, if you have concerns about it, because they did not implement it right away. The reason they didn't implement it right away, though, was because of the fact that it would actually have a fiscal impact to the state's appropriations bill or their budget, based off of us waiving surcharges entirely. And so because of that fiscal impact, they put a delayed date on it so that they could review it at the next legislative session. I suspect it will come up. You might want to keep that in mind. But, yes, I don't know that you're receiving anything. Mm-hmm. And DWLI, yes, sir. Yeah. That's why I'm here. I'm here to provide wonderful information. But yes, so those are the only programs that we have in place. We will start advertising those as well once we're ready to implement them. So we will be providing information out to the customers, and y'all would be able to see that on our website as well. Do y'all have any other questions related to the surcharge program before I move on to the next one? Yes, ma'am.
And then they get notification from the state that the surcharge is going to be assessed. Can they go, oh, I'm indigent, I can't pay that?
Not the way the statute is written. The statute is written is that they determine it at the time of the conviction. So in other words, when the person is before the court originally. So my interpretation is no. They would not be able to actually come back afterwards and say, can you consider me indigent now? No, you should have brought that up at the time. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. You know, that's interesting that you mentioned that. She asked if it's the court's responsibility to advise them of what their surcharges are going to be at the time that they're being convicted. They have tried during the past couple of legislative sessions to put some language in there that were to require the court to provide notification to the customer that you're getting ready to be convicted of an offense that could potentially result in surcharges, and here's what those surcharges would be. That statute has not passed, or that language has not passed in any bill that I've seen. So right now, there's nothing that requires you to be able to do that. And even with the indigency language that they, you know, have implemented for the future, there is still no requirement for you to tell that individual at the time that you have them being convicted. It puts you kind of in one of those positions where potentially you're going to have a customer who's going to come back and say, you know, if I had known, I would have gone ahead and tried for the indigency because I'm really low income and it was all I could do to pay. You didn't tell me. Versus you're telling them with the potential of having a lot of individuals come before you who may not necessarily be indigent, but they're going to try for it anyways. Yes, sir. It depends on how they make their payment. If they use one of the, what we call an alternate method, alternate to mailing it in. Mailing it in, obviously, it's going to take time for it to get through the mail. We usually process that within 24 to 48 hours of the time that they actually receive the mail. So it's still fairly quick when they're on site. But if they do it electronically, like either through our online service or through check by phone, or even the wire transfers, those get processed within 24 hours with the vendor. We still tell the people 24 to 48 just because if there is a glitch with something, it may take an extra day, but usually it's the day after they make the payment, it gets updated, and then it gets sent to us. We still tell people it takes 5 to 7 business days for it to be processed by the department because our prior system was very antiquated. It was 25 years old, and so you're talking about if it went down, you might have issues. We have just recently transitioned to a new driver license system. We did that on April 15th. So basically what happens is when we receive the file from the vendor that night, by the next day that person's record's updated.
So if once you receive it and it comes from the vendor to you,
yes, we actually have what is almost real time with that. It still requires us to run it through a nightly batch process, but it is as close to real time as we've ever had before. Once it gets the payment to the vendor and they update it the same day, they send it to us that night, we update it by the next day. So that means that usually within a 48-hour period of that person making their payment, they should be able to see that their record is updated to eligible, as long as they don't have anything else pending. So, the Omni program is not the same vendor as the surcharge program. Municipal Services Bureau is the vendor for our surcharges. Omnibase is the one that does the failure to appear program. I believe theirs is a lot closer. their program runs on the same batch process that ours does. So if you've submitted it to them, and I don't know what OmniBase's cutoff time is anymore for them to be able to send it to us the same day, but they still send us their files that morning, and by middle of the day, we've ran their file and we've already updated our records, either flagging them for the FTA or removing it. But I don't know what time OmniBase actually runs their process. But theirs is pretty close to the same time period, usually about the 48-hour period from the time that you've entered it. It should be updated on record as well. Yeah. To be able to update it. I know that when we first transitioned over, there was some backlogs that we were trying to, because we had had people hold files for us for about a week time period. So I know we had some issues right at the beginning, but I believe it's been running fairly good since that time period. If you want to get with me later on, though, we can obviously talk about the OmniBase if we need to do some additional research. Okay. Yes, sir. I tell you what, let me answer his. Yes, sir, and then I'll.
What about people that are requesting for adjudication on these cases if they're going to have to pay surcharge?
Well, if you're doing deferred adjudication, if you are processing that and you're not going to convict them of that particular offense, the only time the surcharges get assessed is when we actually receive a report from your court that says we've convicted this person. So if you are dismissing it, or you're going through deferred, or maybe it's a pretrial diversion and the prosecutor's taking care of it, if it's never reported to us, then we're never going to apply it to the record. It's never going to have a surcharge assessed to it. You're welcome. Yes, ma'am. It depends on the court how you actually report it. So what she's asking is how quickly do we get notified? When we receive a file from you, from your court, we will process it, usually within a day or two. It depends on how many courts we're receiving at that time. We have some courts that only report once a month, some that report once a week, some that report every single day. So depending on how you report to us, we'll tell you how quickly it actually ends up on the driver record. Once it's updated to the driver record, our process usually takes about 24 to 48 hours to create the case, because the system has to go through and review it. It's an automated process that says, yes, it meets the criteria, no, it doesn't. Once it meets it, we send it out to the vendor, and they have 72 hours to get the notice out to the customer. So if you're reporting every single day, probably within a week, that customer's going to know they have a surcharge. If you're only reporting once a month, then it may take them a month and a half to know. So, okay, so we're going to go ahead and start talking about the next subject, which is driving while license invalid. And this actually has a whole lot to do with the surcharge program, unfortunately. During the last legislative session, House Bill 1623 was passed, and it had a lot of changes that it made to various portions of the law. And one of the things that it changed was the penalty associated with a DWLI offense. Prior to that, all DWLIs, or what we used to call driving license suspended, was a Class B misdemeanor, which meant that the person got arrested, they were put in jail, they were brought before the judge, and then they were either convicted or dismissed, whatever the judge did. What happened is, with the surcharge program, because we did have so many individuals who were not in compliance and who were being suspended, it caused an overburden to many of the local law enforcement agencies, to the jails, to the courts. So they went before the legislature and said, you need to help us do something with this. And what they did was they changed the law to say that a first-time DWLI offense is a Class C misdemeanor. That means they get the ticket and the officer sends them on their way. Subsequent DWLIs, in other words, if you've already been convicted of it once or if you're suspended for an intoxication offense, remains a Class B misdemeanor, and that's the arrestable offense still. So the reason that this changes is because now it starts coming before traffic courts instead of coming before the county courts, the criminal courts. This affects y'all in the fact that y'all are now actually seeing these where previously you didn't. So one of the things that we're going to discuss about is, okay, first off, when do you determine that it's a Class C versus a Class B? Well, there is some gray area in the way the statute is written, and it's really up to either your local prosecutor or how you work with your local law enforcement agency as to which court they're going to present it to. But when you read the statute, it specifically says that when you're taking that person before the court, if they've been previously convicted or they have the other DWI suspension, that's when you upgrade it to the Class B misdemeanor. We are still seeing a lot of law enforcement agencies that as soon as they have a person pulled over, whether they meet that criteria or not, they're arresting them and taking them before the judge. It's really going to be up to that law enforcement agency and that prosecutor to work together to determine when they're going to issue the citation and when they're actually going to arrest the individual. Once that determination, though, has been made and that person is now before you with, we'll say, the Class C offense, when you convict that individual of it, you can still report that offense in the same manner that you report any other offense to the department. If you're doing it electronically, through the FTP process, if you email it to us, however you do that. There is an offense code for DWLIs. It's 3103. And you would just enter that just like you would a speeding ticket, and you submit the information to us, and we will place that on the driving record.
Are you the one that catches the first or second offense, or?
No.
Course. Yeah. I know a lot of times there's two offenses, and they're just still writing it as Class C.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point. No, we don't. We really leave that up to the courts, because you may have an individual, and unfortunately this is the one of the calls that we get most often is, I have a person who has a DWLI ticket in my court, and now they have a second DWLI ticket in my court, but I haven't convicted them for the first one. What do I do with the second one? That's really going to be your call. If you convict the person of the first one, and now you've got the second one in front of you, you know, you probably need to work with your local county court to determine, hey, we need to send this over to you because we've now convicted a person, and the second one should really be tried as a Class B misdemeanor. This was actually out of the 80th legislative session, and it was the House Bill 1623.
But is it in the code book
yet? Yeah, it should be. Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was in the code book. Yes, ma'am, it's in the transportation code. It's 521.457, I believe. That is the statute that is for driving while license invalid. So it should actually have what when they consider it a Class C and when they consider it a Class B offense. So you would be able to report that to us just as you do with anything else. One of the things that we talk about, though, that can cause some confusion when you're looking at the driving record is determining whether or not the person actually had a DWLI conviction versus an administrative process by the department where we put a DWLI notice on their record. When you look at it, the DWLI conviction actually has their offense date, their notice date, or their conviction date, and you can tell that that person actually has a driving while license invalid conviction. However, there are certain instances where the department, by statute, is allowed to do an administrative process where we can suspend an individual for driving while license invalid, even though they weren't convicted of that type of offense. For example, if we have an individual who is suspended for an intoxication offense, they have a 1-year suspension on their record, and we receive a conviction for speeding from a court. They didn't convict him for DWLI, they just submitted a speeding offense to us, but we can tell that that person is suspended when they received that offense. So what we do is we go through an administrative process, and we can actually add some additional time period to their suspension. It actually gets marked on the record where it says, here's a DWLI suspension, here's their notice date, and here's their beginning and their end date that's associated with it. That is not a DWLI conviction. That is an administrative process only. So if you're attempting to determine if a person actually should be convicted under a Class B misdemeanor or under a Class C, and you look at that, you need to kind of be aware of the fact that there is a difference between those two things. If you're concerned about how to read that driving record, please feel free to give us a call because we'll be more than happy to be able to differentiate that for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's your administration?
Yes. Correct. So on the new driver records, when you see them, we have it broken up where one says enforcement actions. And so under the enforcement actions, you see any time we've done anything with that individual. Suspensions, yes. Anything that we've done, whether it was court-ordered, whether it's an administrative process. And then under your conviction history, or what they call event history, that's where you see all of your convictions. So you should be able to differentiate between the two on the new record that way.
Mm-hmm. The county court. Is information about that occupational license transmitted? Does DPS keep over that?
Yes, we do. We actually maintain it separately on the driving record so we know that that person's been issued an occupational license. One of the great things is with the new system that we went to, we actually issue hard. It looks like a regular driver license. It just says occupational license on it now. It's also a restriction that we have on there, so we can actually tell that we've issued that occupational license. The officer should also be able to tell when he looks at the driver record that there's an occupational license.
Is that going to be on your readout when you take the license
down? I believe so. I would need to look at it to see, because I believe since we consider it one of our restrictions, I know like interlock device required is a restriction now on the record, and you can see it when you look at the driver record under the restrictions. I believe the occupational license appears in that same manner. So, yes, you can see that now. Previously you couldn't, but you can now. Yes, ma'am. It's going to depend then. That would probably, if you from a clerk perspective, when we start talking about the Class C versus Class B misdemeanor, it's really going to be up to the prosecutor to make sure he's charging that individual correctly. If he's not looking at the driver record, then all I can say is, you know, if they convict him of a Class C misdemeanor and it should have been a Class B, the person got really lucky. So, okay. One of the last things that we're going to talk about here with the DWLI is now that we're having it submitted electronically, we have actually encountered one thing that's kind of interesting. When you get ready to submit the conviction to us, there is the no driver license offense that we talked about before versus this offense of driving while license invalid. You need to make sure that when you're reporting that to us that you are very that you're being very careful about making sure that you're reporting the correct offense. And let me give you an example why, because it really comes down to the surcharges that we assessed. You know, we said that no driver license is only $100 a year, but your DWLI is $250. We had an individual, and we've actually had it happen twice now, where they called us up and they were just adamant that they had never had a no driver license conviction. They've always had a driver license. Yes, we can see that your license was valid at the time, but this is what the court reported. And they tell us, no, you have to take that off my record. So obviously we can't do that, but we do contact the court to verify, was this person truly convicted for this particular offense, or maybe should it have been dismissed?
Well,
and it depends. Right, no, it depends on what they're convicted for. If they're convicted for no driver license when maybe it should have been DWLI, if that's what they're convicted for is no driver license, then that's how you enter it. But what ended up happening in these two particular instances is that the person was actually convicted for a DWLI, but it was reported under the no driver license offense. So we had to go back, and the court sent the correction to us. We changed the record from no driver license to DWLI. But in the meantime, we have to tell that individual, yes, we're correcting your record, but you're no longer going to pay the $100 surcharge for the no driver license. You're not going to pay the $250 surcharge for the DWLI. I'm thinking both of those individuals probably would have wished they'd never called us in the first place to tell us, hey, that's wrong. But that's just a reminder of, you know, some of the little things that can happen, you know, just to be very careful that when you're reporting it to us that you really are using either the no driver license or the DWLI offense. Okay. All right. We're going to go on to the next one. This is really informational for y'all, but there's some things that are associated with this ruling that we really want to make sure that we're informing you of, particularly as it pertains to the DWLI. Prior to 2001, the department would actually keep a person suspended even if their suspension period was up, if they still owed us a reinstatement fee. So if we have a person who got two no insurance convictions, so under the safety responsibility law, we're going to go ahead and suspend them for a two-year period, require them to give us the certificate of insurance, and they have to pay a $100 reinstatement fee. Well, if their two-year time period for suspension was up, but they still owed us the reinstatement fee, we still kept them in a suspended status, which meant that that person could be pulled over for DWLI and cited and arrested. And that's particularly what happened in this particular case. Miss Allen was arrested, even though her suspension period was up, because we still had her suspended for not paying her reinstatement fee. The Court of Criminal Appeals said that the department was in violation of the law because we could not continue a suspension once the court or the administrative rule said it was already completed. So we changed our process, and we no longer do that. And what we put on the record instead is a statement that says deny renewal. And what that deny renewal means is that we're not going to renew that person's license until they come in and pay their reinstatement fee. So even if their suspension period is up, if they have 3 years left before their renewal, they have 3 years left before they have to pay us, which is fine. But it causes a slight bit of confusion between deny renewal and the other entry that you will see related to FTAs, which is denied renewal. The deny renewal means that the person still owes us money. But if you have an individual that you've entered into the FTA program, or somebody's entered them into the FTA program, and they've already gone through their time period, their license is now expired, they've never complied with their FTA, we now put them in a status called denied renewal FTA. And what that means is that person is now DWLI, because they have had their driving privileges denied due to failure to comply with some portion of the law. When you look at the driver record, and it's a little clearer now, before you would just see one status that said deny renewal, one that said denied renewal FTA, and it caused a lot of problems for officers to determine, well, when am I really supposed to actually write this person up for DWLI and when am I not. The driver record is now split, so it says administrative status, and the administrative status may tell you it's deny renewal, versus an enforcement action that's under there that says denied renewal FTA. So it's a lot easier to read because we have them separated now. But if you ever encounter that situation, that's just so that you're aware. If a person comes in and all they have is the deny renewal because they still owe us a fee, they are truly not DWLI, and they should not be convicted. Yes, ma'am. It depends. If they have a driver license, the deny renewal is just for them to be able to renew. So usually you see the deny renewal prior to their expiration date. Okay, but the denied renewal FTA occurs after their license has expired and they still haven't complied with their FTA. Then they would probably be, it should be expired driver license, yeah. Because they had a license, it's expired, they never paid their fee, so we're not letting them renew, so it's expired at that time. Okay, so that's, any questions related to that? 10 minutes? Okay. We're going to go ahead and make our way through this last portion. And this one's really something that y'all have probably already dealt with in the past, but we're just going to go over it kind of as a reminder. One of the things that has happened is commercial drivers, as they come before the courts, you know, it used to be that the only time that they could be disqualified from commercial driving privileges is if they had certain types of offenses in a commercial motor vehicle. You know, that's why we have you answer the questions, you know, was it in a commercial motor vehicle? Or were they carrying hazardous materials? Do they have a CDL? Well, that actually changed back in 2005 because the federal government said, okay, look, we want to hold commercial drivers to a higher standard. And with that particular goal in mind, What we are saying now is that regardless of what type of vehicle that person was driving, if they commit an offense that would have previously disqualified them because they committed in a CMV, we're going to disqualify them now, even if they're in their personal vehicle. So the example that we give to individuals, because this is the easiest, is if you have an individual who is in their minivan and they are driving while intoxicated and they get pulled over and they are arrested and convicted for that DWI, that will disqualify them from their commercial driving privileges just as it would have if they had committed it in a CMV. So the things that you see here on things that you would normally see through your courts, like the serious convictions, reckless driving, careless driving if they're following too closely, erratic lane change, speeding 15 miles or more over the posted speed limit, all of those types of offenses that you may see, if you have a person who has a commercial driver license and they are convicted for that offense, that will apply towards their disqualifications under the commercial motor vehicles. One of the things that we also try and make sure that we remind people is that if that individual holds a commercial driver license at the time of the offense, they are not eligible to take defensive driving. That's just because the federal government wants to make sure that if they were truly in violation of the law, that they are not able to circumvent it and potentially circumvent a disqualification that they should have based on that. The DWI is actually one where it's not like the regular serious traffic violations. The two serious traffic violations are traffic violations only. In other words, they got two speeding 15 miles or more over the speed limit. That would disqualify them. Yeah, passing the school bus, the items that are listed there in the statute. But things like a drug offense or a intoxication offense, those are immediate disqualifications the first time they get one of those convictions. So they don't have to accumulate it like they do with the traffic violations.
Is that two speeding tickets 15 miles over, and what period?
I believe it is within a 3-year time period. So two within a 3-year time period, or three within a 4-year time period. They actually, the first, if they have two within a 3-year time period, I believe it's a 60-day suspension that they can have, or 60-day disqualification. If it's three within a 4-year time period, I believe it's 120 days. So, you're welcome. Okay. Sorry, I didn't realize that was there. We provided this list because we actually have a lot of individuals, since we were talking about surcharges and reinstatement fees and people wanting to comply with things on their driver license. It used to be that the only way that you could submit anything to the department was to send it to us in Austin or drive it to us in Austin. We actually have created new compliance offices in the state. We have one in Houston, one in the San Antonio area, and one in the Dallas area in Garland. Yes, this is for individuals who, if they have some type of, maybe they need to provide a reinstatement fee to us, if they need to get a driving record, they can do it also at one of these locations. If they need to submit a certificate of compliance, they can do that as well. The only thing that they cannot do at one of these locations is pay surcharges. Because surcharges actually go through a vendor, we still ask that the vendor be the one who receives the payment from the customer. But again, we provide for all types of options for them to make the payments, even though they can't do it at one of our driver license offices. Do y'all have any questions? Yes, sir. You know, they were looking at doing some more, I believe, like out in West Texas and possibly one lower in the valley. That has not gone to that expansion process yet because we're converting all of our driver license offices over to the new system. But I anticipate that they will probably be looking at doing that. Right. I think they were looking somewhere like around Lubbock as one of the options as well, since I believe that's where one of our regional offices is. But I haven't heard anything else. I would like to take this opportunity to let y'all know I have something that is a pamphlet that we created for distribution, and it's all about the surcharge program. One of the things that we found is that we do have a lot of courts that are in a quandary because how do we notify customers of surcharges when we don't know when or if they're going to be assessed the surcharge? We created the pamphlet in order to be able to provide it out to the courts as well as to our driver license offices so that you can provide it to the customers just as informational or basically to prepare them for what's going to happen. I was the genius who decided that I wanted to order 1 million pamphlets because I thought 1 million's really not that much until I realized it's like 8 pallet full of boxes and I really need to start getting rid of them. Actually, I've done really well. I didn't because the boxes are like this big and I didn't have my car big enough. But what I'm opting to do is to mail them out to your courts free of charge if y'all are interested in receiving some. So I would like to provide you with my telephone number. If you would like to have a couple of boxes mailed to you, all you need to do is just call me and provide me with your court address and your telephone number, and I will be happy to send them to you. My name is Rebecca Hibbs, and my number is 512-424-2953. And that's my direct number, so if you need to, you can leave a message if I happen to not be there, but I will be more than happy to mail them out to you as often as you need them. And I appreciate it. Y'all have a good afternoon.